We're studying the Sermon on the Mount, and we come today to Matthew chapter 7. This chapter consists of several apparently self-contained paragraphs. As we study them, their link with each other is not immediately obvious. Indeed, one may say that there is no very clear connecting theme. Yet it is fair to say that each paragraph treats the Christian's relationship to some person or group. There seem to be seven of them altogether. In verses 1 to 5, there is our relationship to our brother, whether our fellow Christian or our fellow man, in whose eye we may discern a speck of dust and feel it our duty to remove it. In verse 6, there is our relation to a group startlingly designated by Jesus, dogs or pigs. That is the verse about casting your pearls before swine or pigs. They're people, all right, but such is their animal nature that we are not to share God's gospel with them. In verses 7 to 11, there's our relationship to our Heavenly Father, to whom we pray like little children. In verse 12, fourthly, there is our relationship to all men in general, in the golden rule that whatever you would that men should do to you, do to them. That is the law and the prophets. Fifthly, in verses 13 and 14, about the narrow way, there is our relation to our fellow pilgrims who have gone through the narrow gate onto the hard way that leads to life. Sixthly, in verses 15 to 20, there's our relationship to false prophets, of whom Jesus tells us to beware. And seven and last, in the final two paragraphs, verses 21 to 27, there is our supreme relationship to Jesus Christ, our Lord, whose teaching we are to hear, and not only to hear, but to obey. We see, therefore, in this chapter 7 of Matthew's Gospel, this last section of the Sermon on the Mount, that the Christian is involved in a complex network of relationships. His behavior is to be sensitive and discriminating according to the character of each group or person. We come then now to the first paragraph, verses 1 to 5, our relationship to the one Jesus calls our brother. It's not clear that he wants to restrict this to our fellow Christian. The principles are the same if we're thinking of our fellow man. What guidance does Jesus Christ give us in this important human relationship? Well, he makes two fundamental contrasts. He sets before us an alternative in two senses. First of all, he says that the Christian is to be a critic, but not a judge. Maybe I should read to you the first five verses of the chapter so that we are clear about the context. Matthew 7, verses 1 to 5. Judge not, that you be not judged. For with the judgment you pronounce, you will be judged, and the measure you give will be the measure you get. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, "Let me take the speck out of your eye," when there is the log in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. The first contrast, then, that Jesus makes is that the Christian is to be a critic, but not a judge. Perhaps I should mention that verse 1 is very often misunderstood, this "judge not that you be not judged." It is really a question of semantics, of the meaning of words, and it's important for us to remind ourselves that the English word critic is not necessarily the same as a fault finder. Thus, a literary critic reviews books. He is not necessarily passing an unfair or a judgment upon them in which he doesn't approve of the book. He is simply assessing it. He is reviewing it. In the same way, an art critic or a drama critic assesses the merits of the art or the drama concerned. The critic's task, the critic's proper task, is to evaluate, not necessarily to condemn. So it's important for us to ask precisely what Jesus was prohibiting when he says, "Judge not that you be not judged." And I want to say that in the first place, he is not prohibiting criticism. "Judge not" cannot possibly be understood as a command to suspend our critical faculties in relationship to other people. It cannot possibly mean that we are to turn a blind eye to their faults and pretend not to notice them. It cannot be understood as meaning that we are to eschew all criticism, refusing to discern between truth and error on the one hand, or between goodness and evil on the other. How can I be so sure when I say that it cannot possibly mean that? Well, partly because it would not be honest to behave thus. We could only do it by pretense, and that would be hypocrisy, which in this very passage Jesus condemns. But partly also because such behavior would encourage error and evil, and certainly this would not be the purpose of Jesus Christ. Partly also because this would contradict the nature of man, whom God has created in his own image and whom God has made capable of making value judgments. Animals cannot make value judgments. It's one of the distinctive things about human beings. And Jesus Christ is not asking us to contradict our human nature. But the major reason for my confidence that Jesus is not forbidding criticism is because his teaching so far in the Sermon on the Mount assumes that we will use our critical powers and that we will assess people for what they are. Take, for example, Christ's call to be different. How can our righteousness exceed that of the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, as in chapter 5, verse 20, unless we've clearly grasped in what way their righteousness is defective? Again, how can we obey the searching command to do more than others, chapter 5, verse 47, unless we are aware just how we must improve on them? Again, the whole teaching of chapter 6, contrasting Christian piety with Pharisaic piety and Christian ambition with pagan ambition, implies our responsibility to be critical, first in assessing both forms of piety and ambition, and then in rejecting the one in favor of the other. Now, in just the same way, in chapter 7, this very command, "Judge not that you be not judged," is followed almost at once by two further commands. There is the command in verse 6 to avoid giving what is holy to dogs or pearls to swine. And in verse 15, there is the command to beware of false prophets and to discern them by their fruits. Now, these commands would be impossible to obey unless we use our critical judgment. We have to discern who the dogs are, who the pigs and the false prophets are. We have to be able to tell good fruit from evil, and we must go on to modify our behavior accordingly. And we cannot do any of these things if we suspend our critical faculties. So I hope these arguments are sufficient to persuade you that "judge not that you be not judged" is not a prohibition of all criticism. But, on the contrary, it is a prohibition of censoriousness. The follower of Jesus is to be a critic in the sense of using his critical faculties, but he is not to be a judge in the sense of becoming censorious. Censoriousness is a compound sin consisting of a number of unpleasant ingredients. It means not to assess people critically, but to judge them harshly. The censorious critic is the fault finder who enjoys actively seeking out other people's sins. He's negative. He's destructive in his attitudes. He pours cold water on every scheme, and he assumes the worst motives for every action. Worse than that, to be censorious is to set oneself up as a censor. It is to claim a competence and an authority to sit in judgment upon one's fellow men. But this is to cast both myself and my fellows in the wrong role. Since when have they been my servants, who are responsible to me? As the Apostle Paul wrote to the Romans in chapter 14, verse 4, applying Matthew 7:1, "Who are you to pass judgment on the servant of another? It is before his own master that he stands or falls." Again, since when have I become their judge? Of course, some men are indeed called to be judges and magistrates in the civil and the criminal courts of the land. But they do not pass a final or moral judgment on their fellows, and no man has the competence to do so. As Paul wrote to the Corinthians, "It is the Lord who judges me. Therefore do not pronounce judgment before the time, before the Lord comes, who will bring to light the hidden things of darkness," and so on. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 4 and 5. In a word, man is not God. Man is not qualified to be judge, because he cannot read the hearts, and he cannot know the thoughts or the motives of other men. This is something that only God can do. So to be censorious, to stand in judgment upon other people, is to dare arrogantly to anticipate the day of judgment and to assume the role of the divine judge. It is for a man to try to behave like God. Not only is man not the judge, he is himself among the judged. So Jesus says, "Judge not, that you be not judged. For with the judgment you pronounce, you will be judged, and the measure you give will be the measure you get." Jesus warns us of the danger to which we expose ourselves if we start judging other people, if we become censorious. The rationale seems to be this: if we stand in judgment on others, we are giving evidence of our own highly developed powers of critical judgment. And if we pose as judges like that, we cannot claim ignorance of the law that we presume to administer. When we judge others, we give ourselves a feeling of righteousness. We even imagine that we are immune to the things concerning which we're judging others, while actually we are inviting a severer judgment upon ourselves. So, if we enjoy occupying the bench, we must not be surprised to find ourselves in the dock. Take Romans 2, verse 1. "Therefore, you have no excuse, O man, whoever you are, when you judge another. For in passing judgment upon him, you condemn yourself, because you, the judge, are doing the very same things." To sum up then this first alternative, this first contrast that we've been considering, the command, "Judge not, that you be not judged," is not a requirement to be blind to the faults of others, but rather to be generous. It is not that we should cease to be men and suspend the powers of critical judgment which distinguish men from the beasts. It's rather that we should renounce the sinful ambition to be like God. We have no liberty to set ourselves up as judges in any final sense. This responsibility we must leave to God. The follower of Jesus is a critic, but he is not a judge. That, therefore, is the first distinction. Not a critic, but not a judge. Now, the second distinction is rather different. It's this: that the Christian is called to be a brother, but not a hypocrite. Verse 3, "Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, 'Let me take the speck out of your eye,' when there is the log in your own eye, you hypocrite. First take the log out of your own eye, then you'll see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. You see quite clearly the contrast between the hypocrite and the brother. But here with these verses, Jesus goes on to tell his little parable about foreign bodies in people's eyes. Specks of dust on the one hand, and logs or beams on the other. This, then, is a prohibition of hypocrisy. At the beginning of chapter 6 of Matthew, Jesus has exposed our hypocrisy in our duty to God, in giving alms, in praying, in fasting, in order to be seen by men. But here he exposes another kind of hypocrisy, namely in our duty to other people, meddling with their faults while failing to deal with our own. This is another reason why we are unfit to be judges. It's not only because we are humans and fallible and not God, it is also because we are fallen human beings. The fall has warped our judgment. We have a fatal tendency to exaggerate the faults of others and to minimize the gravity of our own. We find it impossible, in comparing ourselves with other people, to be strictly objective and impartial. On the contrary, I'm afraid we have a rosy view of ourselves and a jaundiced view of other people. So, you hypocrite, those words in verse 5, form a key expression of this paragraph. As A.B. Bruce writes in his commentary, censoriousness is a Pharisaic vice, that of exalting ourselves by disparaging others, a very cheap way of attaining moral superiority. The parable of the Pharisee and the publican is the best commentary on this verse. Jesus told it, Luke tells us, to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. The Pharisee made an odious and an inaccurate comparison, exaggerating both his own virtue and the publican's vice. Now, what we should do, of course, is to apply to ourselves at least as strict and critical a standard as we apply to other people. As Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 31, if we judged ourselves truly, we should not be judged. We'd not only escape the judgment of God, we would also be in a position, humbly and gently, to help an erring brother. Having first removed the log from our own eye, we'd see clearly to take the speck from his. So Jesus is prohibiting hypocrisy. But on the other hand, and in contrast to that, he is not prohibiting brotherly correction. In the parable of foreign bodies, as we may call them in people's eyes, some people imagine that Jesus is forbidding any attempt to become moral or spiritual oculists and meddle with other people's eyes. And instead they imagine that Jesus is saying that we've got to mind our own business. But this is not so at all. This would be a very superficial and indeed inaccurate interpretation of this passage. The fact that censoriousness and hypocrisy are forbidden us does not relieve us of our responsibilities to each other. The fact that we are forbidden to play the judge and to play the hypocrite is no excuse for refusing to be a brother. According to Matthew 18, verse 15, if our brother sins against us, our first duty is this: go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. Yet here is a plain Christian duty that is widely neglected. To be sure, in certain circumstances, Jesus Christ is forbidding us to interfere, forbidding us to remove a speck of dust from somebody else's eye, namely, when there is an even bigger foreign body in our own eye which has not yet been removed. But in other circumstances, Jesus actually commands us to reprove and to correct our brother. Once we've dealt with our own eye trouble, then we will see clearly to deal with his. Verse 5. I hope we're clear about this. This is our duty. Not just to see the speck in our brother's eye, verse 3, still less to say to him, verse 4, let me, brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when we haven't removed the log out of ours, but rather, having taken the log from our own eye, verse 5, actually to take the speck from his. So what Jesus Christ is condemning is not criticism, but a criticism of others when there is no comparable criticism of ourselves. Not correction, but correction of others when we've not first corrected ourselves. So we conclude, we need to examine our relationships with other people. Can our behavior towards other people, let's examine ourselves, can it best be described as that of the judge? Is that the kind of person I am, standing or sitting in judgment upon other people, passing sentence on them, harsh, censorious, condemning? Or can our behavior to others better be described as that of the hypocrite, blaming him while always making excuses for myself? Or can our behavior to others best be described as the brother, first blaming and correcting myself, and then seeking to be positive and constructive in the help that I seek to give him? Not just wanting to take a speck out of his eye for the sake of doing it, to give me a sense of superiority, but in order positively to help him, to improve him, to serve him. We need therefore to learn to be as critical of ourselves as we often are of others, and as generous to others as we always are to ourselves. Then we shall be able to anticipate the golden rule of verse 12, whatever you wish that men would do to you, even so do to them, for this is the law and the prophets.